Hey everyone, welcome back and thank you for being here. We've got the animals barking inside. Some of my family is home. I told them that I'm recording, so they may or may not. They shouldn't be any interruptions. We don't have much left, and we were in the middle of, or we're just about just done looking at the second defect of Christianity according to Emerson. After we read these like 5 pages, we may go ahead and do the full life of Wolf Winchester. Come back. Come on. Later. We may do the full life, which is fairly long. Version's a little bit cleaner. Yeah, 28 pages. We're not gonna cover that. If you want to take a look at that yourself, I'm sure that's interesting. But this one's only 19 pages and it's the bulk of our lecture, so we're not gonna. There's gonna be kind of a short series until we add more Emerson stuff later on. Okay. There are mosquitoes and June bugs out here too. But Emerson has reminded us of the direct access to divinity, to deity, spirit, truth. Not only to religion, or like our ability to have religious experiences and directly access God that way, but also to have religious knowledge, and to have knowledge in general. These are not really separate faculties or capacities or blessings of the splendor of what it means to be a human for Emerson. So, yeah. For instance, also, let's just make sure that this looks the way it's supposed to. And we are recording. So go back here. And wide floating meeting controls. Control shift alt H. Nice. Okay. He's also given us two defects of Christianity. Basically, he's criticizing, doctrine or an established prescribed limit of teaching. And also that in some sense he's critiquing the deification of Jesus alone and in itself. Again, as if humans are not also divine or capable of having that same kind of religious knowledge, religious access to God or to philosophical truth. Okay. And yeah, again, where the beauty of nature is part and parcel of this experience or truth. So the first defect seems to largely be about misrepresenting Jesus and the ability of what the human can do. And the second is a consequence of that. That preaching, I think, is more so what he's talking about here, is that preaching has become something deformed as well. And the content of preaching is something like again, a doctrine or some relic that really hasn't been translated into lived experience. Exactly right here. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his old doctrine. And he talks about the good listener, someone who can still hear good lessons even when there's not any particular skill in converting one's mass of experience into essential truths. So we were still, in the second critique or the second error, but he's just about done with them, really. I believe I wanted to go back just a little bit at least. We can start with this one. Oh, yes, there is the lovely mention of the kind of reflexivity of nature as well, that with virtue or wickedness, one's powers as well as the environment, one's environments and environmental augmentations one finds at one's disposal, the trust others give them, the wealth they may lose, investments poorly made, whatever, resources wasted, or sloth not restoring one's resources as one uses them. The enlargement and the shrinking of the soul, as well as the environment and of nature in relation to the soul. In perception, as well as in the actual manifestations or actualizations from an inner plane, it might seem. He mentions that we drink of the universe or the phenomena of God's wonder, a true sense of the splendor of color and quality and experience and beauty as being something beyond the human that we partake of, and not that the mind alone discerns as a matter of taste. Although there is certainly always that element of self-reliance or effort or agreement upon, there's always that element of judgment, assent, so to speak. I was probably reading too fast yesterday too, so let's slow down here and dive back into it. And I think we're probably repeating some stuff, but not too much, maybe like a page. Yeah, I think we're in the middle of page 14. If yeah, that sounds right. Okay. Let me not taint the sincerity of this plea by any oversight of the claims of good men. I know and honor the purity and strict conscience of numbers of the clergy. What life the public worship retains, it owes to the scattered company of pious men who minister here and there in the churches, and who, sometimes accepting with too great tenderness the tenet of the elders, have not accepted from others, but from their own heart, the genuine impulses of virtue, and so still command our love and awe to the sanctity of character. So here he's talking about good preachers who engage the doctrine from their own wisdom. Moreover, the exceptions are not so much to be found in a few eminent preachers as in the better hours, the true inspirations of all, nay, in the sincere moments of every man. But with whatever exception, it is still true that tradition characterizes the preaching of this country, that it comes out of the memory and not of the soul, that it aims at what is Winchester, stop, come back. On. That it aims at what is usual and not at what is necessary and eternal, that thus historical Christianity destroys the power of preaching by withdrawing it from the exploration of the moral nature of man. Where the sublime is, where are the resources of astonishment and power? What a cruel injustice it is to that law, the joy of the whole earth, which alone can make thought dear and rich. That law whose fatal sureness the astronomical orbits purely emulate, that it is travestied and depreciated, that it is behooted and beheld, and not a trait, not a word of it articulated. The pulpit, in losing sight of this law, loses its reason and gropes after it knows not what. Come here, Winchester. Come here. Come lay down. Come on. All right. You guys can see Winchester now. That's cool. Oh. Just stretching. There's either a wasp or oh, it's a hummingbird. Don't know if I can show you guys the hummingbird without it flying away. It flew away last time. See, any sudden movements and the hummingbird goes away. The pulpit and lose. The pulpit and yeah, I read that one, but I'm gonna read it again. The pulpit, in losing sight of this law, loses its reason and gropes after it knows not what. And for want of this culture, the soul of the community is sick and faithless. It wants nothing so much as a stern, high, stoical Christian discipline to make it know itself and the divinity that speaks through it. Now, man is ashamed of himself or herself. He skulks and sneaks through the world to be tolerated, to be pitied, and scarcely in 1,000 years does any man dare to be wise and good, and so draw after him the tears and blessings of his kind. This probably is not a bad tears. I don't really agree with. He could be saying that, or the tears could be like tears of rejoicement or tears of compassion. Certainly, there have been periods when, from the inactivity of the intellect on certain truths, a greater faith was possible in names and persons. The Puritans in England and America found in the Christ of the Catholic Church and in the dogmas inherited from Rome scope for their austere piety and their longings for civil freedom. But their creed is passing away, and none arises in its room. I think no man can go with his thoughts about him into one of our churches without feeling that what hold the public worship had on men is gone or going. It has lost its grasp on the affection of the good and the fear of the bad. In the country, neighborhoods, half parishes are signing off, to use the local term. It is already beginning to indicate character and religion to withdraw from the religious meetings. I have heard a devout person who prized the Sabbath say in bitterness of heart, on Sundays it seems wicked to go to church. And the motive that holds the best there is now only a hope and a waiting. What was once a mere circumstance that the best and the worst men in the parish, the poor and the rich, the learned and the ignorant, young and old, all these different people, all these different classes and professions, and normally, I guess you'd say silos of experience, discrete silos of experience that usually do not intermingle. Emerson is claiming that a given community religious center on Sunday, usually of the same faith, although he was Unitarian, quote, should meet one day as fellows in one house in sign of an equal right in the soul. And then instead, that has come to be a paramount motive, not instead, instead of it being a mere circumstance, that has come to be a paramount motive for going to church or to one place together to do religious, to have a community religious experience, not just a personal religious experience. So, but yeah, the church. And here he's wrapping up the two errors. I'm going to restate them. And then the next paragraph, he will ask our fourth question, the guiding questions. And now, my brothers, what in these responding days can be done by us? What two benefits does Emerson argue Christianity offers as starting points? This one may come after. Yeah, so this is way later. So skip that one for now. But two inestimable advantages Christianity has given us: the Sabbath and preaching. The Sabbath, the jubilee of the whole world, whose light dawns, welcome alike. This is the second to last paragraph. Yeah, the very last paragraph on the second to last page, or the second to last paragraph, whichever way you want to cut it. First, the Sabbath, the jubilee of the whole world, whose light dawns welcome alike into the closet of the philosopher, into the garret of Pleyel, and into prison cells, and everywhere suggests, even to the vile, the dignity of spiritual being. Let us stand forevermore a temple, which new love, new faith, new sight shall restore to more than its first splendor to mankind. And secondly, the second benefit of Christianity is the institution of preaching, the speech of man to men, essentially the most flexible of all organs of all forms. What hinders that now, everywhere in pulpits and lecture rooms and houses and fields, wherever the invitation of men or your own occasions leads you, you speak the very truth as your life and conscience teach it, and cheer the waiting, fainting hearts of men with new hopes and new revelation. So we'll come back to that later. I should probably swap these around. I'm sure in the podcast, it's easy to swap on the podcast. I'll do it in the online resource doc too. Titter tatter from the rain is really making me speak up. What in these desponding days can be done by us? Let's start there. And now, my brothers, you will ask, what in these desponding days can be done by us? The remedy is already declared in the ground of our complaint to the church. We have contrasted the church with the soul. In the soul, then, let the redemption be sought. Wherever a man comes, there comes revolution. The old is for slaves. When a man comes, all books are legible, all things transparent, all religions are forms. He is religious. Man is the wonder worker. He is seen amid miracles. All men bless and curse. He saith yea and nay only. The stationariness of religion, the assumption that the age of inspiration is past, that the Bible is closed, the fear of degrading the character of Jesus by representing him as a man, indicate with sufficient clearness the falsehood of our theology. It is the office of a true teacher to show us that God is not was. So I think these are some of the things we can do so far. That he speaketh not spake. The true Christianity, a faith like Christ's in the infinitude of man, is lost. None believeth in the soul of man, but only in some man or person old and departed. Ah me, no man goeth alone. All men go in flocks to this saint or that poet, avoiding the God who seeth in secret. They cannot see in secret. They love to be blind in public. They think society wiser than their soul. And know not that one soul and their soul is wiser than the whole world. See how nations and communities flit by on the sea of time and leave no ripple to tell where they floated or sunk. And one good soul shall make the name of Moses or of Zeno or of Zoroaster reverend forever. So if you are in my 1304 class listening to this or following along outside of the class or whatever, which is Introduction to World Religions. Then Moses is from the Abrahamic religions. He's respected in all three. I guess all four. I do believe you might consider Sikhism a form of, maybe not, maybe it's monotheistic, but it might not be Abrahamic. I'll have to double check on that. But certainly Judaism, which started with Yahwism, which is a form of polytheism, but Judaism, Christianity and Islam all revere Moses as a central prophet. They don't disagree there. Zeno is a Greek philosopher, a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher. Double check that it's pre-Socratic, but I'm like pretty sure it is. Yep. I know that's a crow or like a bird or a frog. Yeah, whatever. Zoroaster also influenced the monotheistic religions, though. And in fact, there's sort of this Greek Zoroaster, I would say largely because of Alexander's conquest to the region. The Roman Empire overtook the area for some time. Those are separate things. Alexander was not Roman. I don't think so. He might have been. Ancient Greek Macedon. So I don't really I started this book called Into the Land of Bones. Right? Is that what it's called? Yeah. Which is a history of that campaign. Really interesting, but would be fun to lecture on probably. I could totally do some stuff about that when we got to like Zoroaster and Judaism. Anyway, not Zoroaster, Zoroastrianism. It's a Persian or like Iranian, Afghani, mostly, I guess you'd say Persian religion. It's there in the Middle East of Asia. Coming into conflict with a lot of things, including Islam in the 7th and 8th centuries. I guess 8th century. Maybe 7th soon. I'm really bad with dates. And like 1300 years ago, 1400 years ago, mostly, I mean, especially for an intro class, mostly the same thing. Let's keep going. And one good soul shall make the name of Moses or Zeno or Zoroaster reverend forever. None assayeth the stern ambition to be the self of the nation and of nature, but each would be an easy secondary to some Christian scheme or sectarian connection or some eminent man. Once leave your own knowledge of God, your own sentiment, and take secondary knowledge as St. Paul's or George Fox's or Swedenborg's, and you get wide from God with every year this secondary form lasts. And if, as now for centuries, the chasm yawns to that breadth, that men can scarcely be convinced that there is in them anything divine. Let me admonish you, first of all, to go alone, to refuse the good models, even those which are sacred in the imagination of men, and dare to love God without mediator or veil. So what can be done? Also a very prominent point that he's saying here. Go alone. Friends enough you shall find who will hold up to your emulation, Wesley's and Oberlin's, saints and prophets. Thank God for these good men that say, I also am a man. Imitation cannot go above its model. The imitator dooms himself to hopeless mediocrity. The inventor did it because it was natural to him, and so in him it has a charm. In the imitator, something else is natural, and he buries himself in his own beauty and comes short of another man's. Yourself, a newborn bard of the Holy Ghost, cast behind you all conformity and acquaint men at first hand with deity. Look at it first and only that fashion, custom, authority, pleasure, and money are nothing to you, are not bandages over your eyes that you cannot see, but live with the privilege of the immeasurable mind, not too anxious to visit periodically all families and each family in your parish connection. When you meet one of these men or women, be to them a divine man, be to them thought and virtue. Let their timid aspirations find in you a friend. Let their trampled instincts be genially tempted out in your atmosphere. Let your doubts know that you have doubted, or let sorry, let their doubts know that you have doubted, and their wonder feel that you have wondered. Certainly doubted and wondered. By trusting your own heart, you shall gain more confidence in other men. For all our penny wisdom, for all our soul-destroying slavery to habit, it is not to be doubted that all men have sublime thoughts, that all men value the few real hours of life. They love to be heard. They love to be caught up into the vision of principles. We mark with light in the memory the few interviews we've had in the dreary years of routine and of sin, with souls that made our soul, that made our souls wiser, that spoke what we thought, that told us what we knew, that gave us leave to be what we inly were. Discharged to men the priestly office, and present or absent, you shall be followed with their love as by an angel. So one, we learn to trust ourselves because we think some certain things that we're afraid to claim to be true, right? In self-reliance, he says, say it or somebody else will say it first. You'll see it tomorrow in the newspaper. But through that process, you will, in fact, start to trust what you see, or in what you see inwardly matter. Is what I mean. And after time, then you just say it first. It's not so much, I mean, I don't know.
I can't speak to how frequently one misperceives or hallucinates, shall we say, what a normative claim or an essential claim, an eidetic claim would be. But presumably that improves over time and through repeated practice and failure. By trusting your own heart, you know, that's all it. And to this end, let us not aim at common degrees of merit. We not leave to such as love it the virtue that glitters for the commendation of society, and ourselves pierce the deep solitudes of absolute ability and worth. We easily come up to the standard of goodness in society. Society's praise can be cheaply secured, and almost all men are content with those easy merits. But the instant effect of conversing with God will be to put them away. There are persons who are not actors, not speakers, but influencers, persons too great for fame or display, who disdain eloquence, to whom all we call art and artist seems too nearly allied to show. And by ends, the exaggeration of the finite and selfish and loss of the universal. So I think he's commending these sorts of seers. The orators, the poets, the commanders encroach on us only as fair women do, by our allowance and homage. So some I'm not like, flippant to call it sexism, or jumping towards that conclusion. I wouldn't use that turn of phrase or that example in the in today. But in a way, he's also saying that we're responsible for our behavior, and it's not like how a woman dresses that causes bad things to happen to her. So I'm not saying it's benevolent sexism either. Anyway, I wouldn't say it that way today. Slight them by preoccupation of mind, slight them as you can well afford to do by high and universal aims, and they instantly feel that you have right and that it is in lower places that they must shine. Well, if he means that about fair women, then that is certainly sexist. You should spend time with people, all people. They also feel you're right, for they with you are open to the influx of the all-knowing spirit, which annihilates before its broad noon the little shades and gradations of intelligence and the compositions we call wiser. And wisest, the comparative and the superlative. In such high communion, let us study the grand strokes of rectitude, a bold benevolence, and independence of friends, so that not the unjust wishes of those who love us shall impair our freedom, but we shall resist our truth's sake, the freest, shall resist for truth's sake. The freest flow of kindness and appeal to sympathies far in advance. And what is the highest form in which we know this beautiful element? A certain solidity of merit that has nothing to do with opinion, and which is so essentially and manifestly virtue that it is taken for granted that the right, the brave, the generous step will be taken by it, and nobody thinks of commending it. So, somebody who's such a good person that nobody thinks to thank them for it or just what they ought to do when they do it. You would compliment a coxcomb doing a good act, but you would not praise an angel. The silence that accepts merit as the most natural thing in the world is the highest applause. Such souls, when they appear, are the imperial guard of virtue, the perpetual reserve, the dictators of fortune. One needs not praise their courage. They are the heart and soul of nature. Oh, my friends, there are resources in us on which we have not drawn. There are men who rise refreshed on hearing a threat, men to whom a crisis which intimidates, and women too, and paralyzes the majority, demanding not the faculties of prudence and thrift, but comprehension, immovableness, the readiness of sacrifice. Comes graceful and beloved as a bride. Napoleon said of Massena that he was not himself until the battle began to go against him, that when the dead began to fall in ranks around him, awoke his powers of combination, and he put on terror and victory as a robe. So it is in rugged crises, in unweariable endurance, and in aims which put sympathy out of question that the angel is shown. But these are heights that we can scarce remember and look up to without contrition and shame. Let us thank God that such things exist. Terror and victory as a robe. I think grief feels like that, you guys. And the urgency of the awareness of death. And now let us do what we can to rekindle, second to last paragraph. And now let us do what we can to rekindle the smoldering, nigh quenched fire on the altar of the soul. The evils of the church that now is are manifest. So the church we're critiquing. The question returns, what shall we do? I confess, all attempts to project and establish a cultus with new rites and forms seem to me vain, right? Because we need to be anarchistic about it. We cannot prescribe something. Faith makes us and not we it, and faith makes its own forms. All attempts to contrive a system are as cold as the new worship introduced by the French to the goddess of reason, today, pasteboard and filigree, and ending tomorrow in madness and murder. Rather, let the breath of new life be breathed by you through the forms already existing. For if once you are alive, you shall find they shall become plastic and new. So, assuming that not everybody is necessarily alive, look at that dog hair. Shedding. But once that perception comes about, you shall find they shall become plastic anew. The remedy to their deformity is first soul and second soul and evermore soul. A whole popedom of form is one pulsation of virtue can uplift and vivify. Two, and again, going to the third question. Two inestimable advantages, or the fourth, once I've swapped it. Two inestimable advantages Christianity has given us. First, the Sabbath, the Jubilee of the whole world, whose light dawns, welcome alike, into the closet of the philosopher, into the garret of toil, and into prison cells. And everywhere suggests, even to the vile, the dignity of spiritual being. Let it stand forevermore, a temple, which new love, new faith, new sight shall restore to more than its first splendor to mankind. And secondly, the second inestimable advantage Christianity has given us is the institution of preaching. The speech of man to men, essentially the most flexible of all organs of all forms. What hinders that now everywhere in pulpits and lecture rooms, in houses and fields, wherever the invitation of men or your own occasions lead you, you speak the very truth as your life and conscience teach it and cheer the waiting, fainting hearts of men with new hope. A new revelation. What hinders that now is what he's asking. Final paragraph, very short, almost done. I look for the hour when that supreme beauty, which ravished the souls of those Eastern men and chiefly of those Hebrews, and through their lips spoke oracles to all time, shall speak in the West also. The Hebrew and Greek scriptures contain immortal sentences that have been bread of life to millions, but they have no epical integrity or fragmentary. Are not shown in their order to the intellect. I look for the new teacher that shall follow so far those shining laws. It's interesting to compare laws, lowercase laws, with capital L law. And he uses both. He uses capitalizes ought, duty, science, beauty, joy. Capitalizes teacher as well, but not intellect. I look for the new teacher that shall follow so far those shining laws that he shall see them come full circle, shall see their rounding complete grace, shall see the world to be the mirror of the soul, shall see the identity of the law of gravitation with purity of heart, and shall show that the ought, the duty is one thing with science, with beauty, and with joy. Heck yeah. Unity of moral law, natural law. There's some sense that the world you experience really is a product of your moral desert. And maybe in a way that's deeper, that's a reflection, not just psychologically, but also metaphysically. It might be a truly different kind of world that unfolds. Causally, certainly, any kind of material causation, any kind of social causation, any kind of self-perception, those are going to have affective consequences, which ripple beyond the internal demonstrations of the mind or the internal meditations, what have you. Yeah, one of my friends said purity of heart makes the trains run on time, right? So, when you're late, you're not in your vibe, you're not doing the right thing, everything can feel like it's working against you. And when you're going the right way, stuff should flow pretty readily. So, I don't know if we'll record anything else in the rain. I'll take a look at what else is ready. And we'll see you soon, guys. Thanks for being here. That's it for Emerson. I hope you had fun. It's like debris and stuff out of here. All right. If you're one of my students, just let me know if you have any further questions or leave a comment on the video. Or yeah. Thanks, guys. Winchester's still right here, but he is laying down and chilling, and I'm not going to mess with him. Y'all take care.